have a question for you. I empathized with what your experience with your advisor. I've been dealing with my own advisors in grad school these days, and I'm searching for an advisor who can support some of the work that I do. And if I can't find somebody who can support the work that I want to do, then I'm out too, pretty soon. So it's all kind of contingent on that this year, and we'll see how it goes. I wonder about, did you talk to your advisor about using the word anarchism in your work and with your other faculty people that you work with? And what kind of comments have you, what kind of conversations have you had about that with people?
I actually don't have any stories about that because I didn't even broach that, you know?
I'd like to hear from others as well.
Yeah, so yeah. Because I was in a program, it was a religious studies program, so it would have been so, I don't know, I just didn't even get to that point of, like, pushing a specifically anarchist label. I think I was just sort of exploring, like, you know, how, what sort of programs of study I could do to, like, at least get the most critical theory under my belt and whatever. And, yeah. Do other people, I've heard so many horror stories about that somebody in the room must have.
I can actually respond to it. I just finished my master's degree in cultural studies. Mm-hmm. Which has a different series of issues because it's an interdisciplinary study. So certain things you're talking about I didn't come up against, but there was nobody in my department who wanted to deal with what I was doing. You know, and there was really, and because it's interdisciplinary, we're given the freedom to find out advisors in other spaces, right? I also have a lot of years outside from my undergraduate to my graduate, which I think for myself it was really significant for my own anxieties about academia. I didn't really have advisors through my thesis, and I struggled on that, but I found some people who were good, who became good mentors. If I kept knocking my head against the wall, it happened, and fortunately, a friend of mine who's here too entered my program who's beginning to think about some of these ideas. I think there's some shifts going on because culturally there's shifts going on with anarchism, and in certain universities there's more people beginning to come in and do this work. And now that I just finished, I'm finding a lot more people outside of it that's making me feel more comfortable taking on that aspect of things in my work, which has always been a great anxiety for myself as well. So, I mean, I just took a DIY perspective on what I was doing because that's how I've lived my life. And I didn't, you know, academia wasn't, because I had anxieties going into it, I didn't really think I was going to necessarily find, I was really disappointed with how limited it was. And I know that the place I was at was wrong. One of the things, I'm just going to, for like one more second, one of the things I was thinking about where, and what y'all were, because you're talking about Harvard and McGill, which is a Harvard North, I don't know, I mean, whatever, right. I went to Claremont, which has some claim to having some reputation out in, you know, like, you know, in California, which I don't know. But, you know, my undergraduate was at Antioch, which has no claim to any intellectual, you know, reputation, but a really great school for a lot of other reasons. I think there might be, for me, there was a question in thinking about where the, some of the things you're bringing up, where the anxieties, the roles, the pressures on people teaching in a place like Harvard versus somebody teaching at a state school that is in Long Beach or, you know, or other places where some of those pressures are different. And I think that broadens, like, maybe where, how to start breaking down some of those concerns, and maybe as taking an anarchist frame, what that means when one decides to enter into the academy is one deciding to enter into the best place, or is one just recognizing maybe there's a place where you can get intellectual stimulation that you can't always get outside of it, and so that was sort of what I was thinking.
I have a story about this kind of thing. I mean, this is in English universities, and my PhD advisor at the time a few years ago was editing an encyclopedia of democratic thought to be published by Routledge, and he gave me the list of entries that various people, he was going to get various people to write about 100 entries, you know, liberal democracy, rule of law, human rights, etc. And there was no anarchism one there. And I said, Joe, where's anarchism? And he said, well, you know, haven't got it. I said, well, but, you know, I mean, it's, you know, related to democratic thought. And he said, well, this is a kind of encyclopedia of liberal democratic thought, so it doesn't fit. And so, you know, and I wanted to write an entry on anarchism for it, and he wouldn't have that. So, but he did offer me to, he did ask me to write an entry on something else, which is, which was a kind of vague idea I kind of somehow came up with somewhere for in my PhD, but I had no idea what the idea was. It was just a term, which I'm going to talk about this afternoon, mortgage democracy. And so what I decided to do is, he said, yeah, write 2,000 words for this encyclopedia on mortgage democracy. And I didn't know what I was going to write about, but I decided, since he wouldn't accept the anarchism entry, to turn this thing, other thing that he offered me, into something on anarchism. So I did write about anarchism, but kind of in a quiet way, and didn't even, I mean, if you come to what I say this afternoon, you know, I don't talk about anarchism until the very, very end. I saw no other way of getting any anarchist content into this encyclopedia that nobody will read anyway, because it costs, you know, about $107. You know, any library can buy it. So, which is another kind of story about academic publishing. And I could go on about this kind of thing.
I was just going to throw this out. Like, what about, say, us technocrats? Like us, those of us that did, like, I did my undergrad in mathematics, and I'm doing graduate work in mathematical economics. And so, like, oh, my work is going to be around collecting statistics and, like, technical work that you kind of can't do outside of an academic setting, like, especially with engineering and computer science and things like that. And and do we need those people? How can you do that in, like, a revolutionary way or an anti-capitalist way and still, like do constructive technical work and stuff like that? I'd be curious if people have opinions on that.
Just to add to that, I studied in a professional school of forestry, and engineering, forestry, education, medicine are all, I think, really distinct fields within academia that are really guided by a set of principles, codes of ethics, guidelines, and are really job-oriented disciplines that require specific attention, because often they're very disassociated from a free theoretical exploration of the foundation and the direction which they're going. And there's this real tendency to emphasize the need for those job-creating disciplines nowadays, and yet they're going along without any really solid theoretical development and discourse. I find it very scary.
What were the kinds of fields that you were talking about?
Forestry, engineering, teaching, medicine. Disciplines that, in the end, you're seeking to develop certified individuals that fit job criteria. And my experience is that there's a real reluctance to look at the nature of, among professional disciplines, to look at the nature of those disciplines and to criticize themselves, whereas within non-professional disciplines, in the arts particularly, there's a tendency for everyone to continually criticize and continually reflect. So there's a real... I find it frightening, because these are people who are actually running the infrastructure of our society, you know, building our roads, teaching our children, clear-cutting our forests, you know?
Well, I think what you were talking about in terms of technical academia is interesting, because if you think about the supposed reason for academia, as you were talking about, in terms of an independent body that can be critical of society, that can produce critical thought in some way. And if you look at what informs what research is done, what statistics are collected, what science is developed in the academia these days, it's informed by corporate ideas of what is good and not by community ideas of what is good. And it's... I've thought a lot about how we can reclaim that role that technical academia is supposed to play in our society, because looking at trying to make science or all of those, or engineering or anything like that, accessible to a lot of people, because it's just learning a certain discourse or language or way to think about things, but at the same time, how do we have people that are developing our technologies that are responsible to us? And I don't know if you've thought about that, if anyone has, and how do we have to create alternative institutions and get a whole bunch of funding for labs that you can't really find the funding anywhere else than like biotech corporations these days? Or no.
Yeah, I just want to respond to Christy. I think it's a really important point. In terms of having the academy or whatever be sort of responsible to someone or to a community in particular, I think in theory that sounds like a really an excellent idea. However, there's automatic questions about academic integrity, academic freedom. You know, what happens if you go against the community's values? Mm-hmm. So then you're sort of, then you're caught in catch-22 again. So, I mean, it's something we need to continually think about. But from a person who, or from the perspective of a professor, he or she's going to want the ability or want the freedom to say anything he or she wants to say and sort of not be strictly accountable to a set of virtues or whatever that comes out of community. How we develop that, I don't know. That's something that, you know, should be an ongoing discussion.
Have we missed anybody who had their hand up and I just didn't see?
It is Russell Jacoby. I play basketball with him. So that's how he pronounces it. Anyway.
Edit the sound.
No, it's his personal choice. There's a defense of that abstruse, arcane, technical language, and I'll make something like it, and I don't necessarily agree with it, but. If you're going to be thinking in a revolutionary way, sometimes the language that and the vocabulary that you inherit is not enough to make sense of what you're trying to say, and that there's a praxis of neologism that is important, and that can often sound simply defending privilege and an insider knowledge of the meanings of the terms that are being used, and which in many cases is, there's no question about it. But there's also a sense in which, if you think of someone like Judith Butler or Spivak, that you mentioned, who do not write in ordinary English language, you know, prose.
Which is why I used her. Like, I did it deliberately because it's not something I really want to give up either.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
On some level.
Yeah, that's. It's difficult to imagine how you'd say what Judith says without being as confusing as she is, because she's trying to confuse things. She's trying to mix things up and make us think in a different way, and that may require a type of language that isn't available like fast food. I mean, I'm not being derogatory, but I mean, like, it's not something that you just don't think about when you're reading it. It's something that requires that you spend a lot of time with trying to figure out what it is, why is she saying it that way, and what it is that she's saying. So, anyway.
Do you think so? I mean, are you convinced that that's the case? Are you convinced that we can't... Hang on, can I finish?
Yeah.
Sorry, because it is a question.
Yeah.
That we need to be saying things in much more difficult ways than we might. I was reading a lot of Marx stuff last quarter in a seminar on Marx and critical theory, and I took... we were doing a lot of Frederick Jameson, and he writes, he writes dialectically, and he has these sentences that are like a paragraph long, and the editors of this book that was a collection of his essays wrote an introduction and said, he writes the way that he does to purposely trip us up and slow us down so that we'll think about what he's saying. And he also talks about the way that we can't I'm going to muddle this point, so I'm not going to try, but that's one of the points that they make. I really go back and forth, and I've gone, like, throughout my academic sort of career, I've gone back and forth kind of arguing one side, we need this difficult language, we need these words, we need the neologisms because we need new language to talk about these ideas, and then going, well, wait a minute, this is so incredibly elitist and inaccessible to, like, most of the people that I work with and that I want to be working with as an educator. It's really problematic. And so I straddle the fence sometimes, and I land on one side sometimes, and I land on the other side sometimes. So I'm not convinced of that yet. I wonder whether you are.
I did make it as a straw argument, but I agree to a certain extent. Yeah, I think that a good test is when you read Fred Jameson, could you write it, could you capture what he's trying to say in a different, more accessible, more transparent language? And if you can, then there's reason to say, well, then he's bullshitting. But if not, then I think there's something to be said about an opacity, a translucency of the text.
Can I add something to this? I guess one of the things, I mean, again, I don't really feel like giving up Butler or Spivak, which is why this concerns me, because I'd like to go back to the point I tried to make about the way in which specialized discourse is not only inaccessible to, like, the large number of people we organize with, because you could argue then that, well, that's my job, is to, you know, rewrite it so that it's totally accessible, and so it's not really a problem. You can still have the ideas. But I do see it a problem because to me, the constant production of this stuff, most of it which isn't nearly as good or as politically grounded as Butler's or Spivak's, does really justify sort of enclosed campuses, functions to, like, to me, to legitimate the gates around our campuses, the fact that, like, all these poli-sci professors can unpack sort of, you know, the drug war in Colombia for you, but have no sense of, like, the fact that they can only be talking about it because the Colombian woman who's sending money home to her kids comes in at 5:30 to, like, clean their office. And those sorts of connections and the questions about what it does to your theory and to your language when you put your body in specific places, which is such a simple point and it seems like such a cliche, but is there such an important link in this argument, I think, and I think if we thought about that more, we might have more qualms about allowing specialized languages to, or discourses, to sort of hold the legitimacy that they have. So any thoughts about that? Because that's my other big question. It's like, what you do with your body as you theorize is clearly important in some way. So what is that link, though, you know? And, or what are the many ways in which that's true, and what implications do they have?
This was a question, I think it's somewhat connected to what you're saying. I'm thinking about, because I was thinking about your, I mean, you guys did a great presentation, and it's well-researched, and I was thinking, okay, that's interesting, and I don't know, you're obviously not at the same school, so you have some way of working together that's outside of the academy, that's using all this theory, that finds all these resources, that obviously you've been taught the skills, because you've both gone to a certain degree in your education to do that, but somehow you've created the space to go and read Jacoby outside of a classroom, which, Lord knows, when I'm not in class, that's not what I'm reading. So, I was very excited to read my first fiction book in 2 years. So in some ways, I mean, I was a little curious about that, and maybe that starts getting to some of what you're talking about, where your body is and how our relationships to this stuff is, and alternative ways we're doing that, and how we find ways to continue to inspire ourselves to work together to do that work outside of the structured environment that for many of us can go in there and be really, you know, disciplined overachievers when we have this pressure of deadlines, but outside of it, I want to kick back, you know? So I don't know. So, you know, I don't know if that answers, or if other people talk about ways they find that stimulation and discourse outside of the academy, because that's one of the reasons why I did choose to go there, because I was a little tired of not having it, so.
Yeah, I don't write anything without a deadline, which is why this was really useful, like, I wouldn't, you know. Yeah. I mean, I'd be interested, and I think it connects to Christy's question, what sort of alternative institutions, you know, do we need to create or proliferate, or what, you know?
And also, like, about that demanding overachiever stuff, like, how do we create institutions that don't set us up so that we wind up internalizing their values and stuff, like, so that we're not like, oh my god, I'm not getting good grades, and like, and like setting ourselves up like that, so that half the radicals I know are just like, we're all stressing about like our marks. and like, yeah, what would an academic institution look like that kept standards but didn't like beat us with psychological sticks when we don't need to.
I'm not sure how this plugs into what's being said, but this is what I think in response to what's being said. So I write scholarly work, I hope it's scholarly, but it's not theoretical. It's just, you know, I do research on the local historical figures of my town. And while I was educated, I don't have a degree, and so I know that I'm in a different social set from where you're coming from, and it also means that I don't have the resources available to me to use in my research, and that's where I feel it the most keenly. And I can't publish in the same journals and so forth. So that's, you know, the first way I can feel it. But on the other hand, it's you said your advisor had said that the Academy is all a secondary engagement, and you know, I paint houses and do other things, manual things for a living, when I'm not, you know, fanaticizing it in an archive and going through old papers. So this doesn't leave a lot of time for activism, which makes me feel that I'm separating from the anarchist group that I belong to, and so it still separates me from what I was doing earlier. You know, the actual pounding the pavement and doing the actual activism and organizing. So if it's not physically happening in front of your face, and you're spending a huge amount of time writing about it and thinking about it and researching it, maybe it's always got to be a way of separating you from anarchism, the practice of anarchism. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's...
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. I think it's something we all view it. I mean, what I would like to suggest, though, is that we don't think of this in terms of a zero-sum game. Is that if, you know, I think we have to think also in terms of a richer understanding of what an intellectual is. If you're not writing theory, doesn't mean you're not intellectual. I think there's intellectuals or scholars who will interpret Butler and make sense of it to the larger audience. And I mean, that's a skill. I mean, if you can read Butler, understand her, and then articulate to somebody in a way that you know, they're able to critique gender or power or whatever, I mean, that's brilliant. Okay, so I think we need to be able to think of, you know, in the intellect or the intellectual in a much greater sort of scope. Also, I think when it comes to praxis, I think one of the constant, sort of related to this first point, is that, you know, when you are in the academy, when you are teaching, or when you are painting houses, I mean, I don't think you can look at it as that you're not doing activism. I mean, I think it has to be something that's integrated into life. I think this really goes back to what Kropotkin is all about. And it really is perhaps a step toward a more radical society, a more radical understanding of culture and vocation. That, you know, we want to move out of these sort of binary oppositions. Now I'm in the academy, now I'm in the community. And that's problematic if you're still working with that paradigm. So, again, I don't have the answer for that. I mean, I don't have the... I mean, I think that's some of the barriers that we need to break down. I don't necessarily have the solution for that. And again, I think this is sort of where we are today in terms of renewing an anarchist tradition, is coming up with a tradition or sort of being in the tradition, but also recognizing its dynamic and in dialogue with each other, we are starting to build something that's more radical. So, that's another one.
My question there, too, would be, when you're talking about people interpreting Butler to a larger audience, like, a question would also be, where does the theory come from? Like, you know, it's essentially, like, sometimes, yeah, theory comes from the academy and gets brought to people, but I think a lot of times theory is sort of developed and dependent out of the way people explain themselves to themselves who are doing, work. Like, it's no coincidence that Foucault and all these people started writing their best stuff right after the big Paris 68 stuff. I don't know. So, like, to what extent does theory especially like scholarly theory, not parasitical exactly, but to what extent does it just formulate stuff that's already there? That's what Kropotkin says when he talks about anarchist communism. He says, I didn't come up with this, I'm just talking about it. It's really came out of, you know, a movement.
Lisa. Well, just to throw this out there, I think it's also really important to think about who has had the access to theory and therefore what theory has been developed. And if we're looking even just at this room, and overwhelmingly we're white people who probably have had the privilege to be able to spend time reading about theory. And a lot of times people say, well, then let's just give people the opportunity to read about theory. But if we actually really think about what's connected to people's lives and what things they care about, maybe they don't care to read Foucault, but as you said, they do understand the locus of power within their organizing or their communities or whatever, and they speak about it in a different way. And they also are interested in developing different things. And I think it's something that we all really need to think about and struggle with in terms of what theory is related to what activism, and how, as organizers, we understand we have to take time to think ourselves, but then also building with people that are doing different things in different places and different cultures, and just to think about how we can develop the theory with all of the differences as well, instead of letting it be perpetuated by a certain language, even though we're trying to deconstruct a discourse here or whatever we're trying to do. But
if that makes any sense. Just to kind of add to that, we've been talking about theory here as something outside, and I'm not sure that that's really all that fruitful, as well as I'm not particularly sure that Jameson has to be accessible to anyone who doesn't read Marx. For all intents and purposes, it seems to me like Jameson and Spivak are doing the same thing to Marx and Foucault that Adbusters does to Nike and that the Luddites did to the machinery. It's just different ways of expressing the same sense of disruption. So I'm not sure that, like, theory has to come down, because what theory's talking about is already there.
Wait, can you say different ways of expressing the same sense of disruption?
Disruption.
What do you mean?
That
by
was
that?
Just completely inarticulate. different ways of exposing the breaks or creating the breaks in different discourses that seek to be the dominant discourse, whether it be the discourse of Marxist ideology or the discourse of corporate America.
I was just going to kind of echo what the past few people have said about kind of dealing with organizing or activism versus theory, and that's something that I've been struggling with a lot. And I find a lot of times kind of people who are really focused on theory aren't really interested in actual organizing, versus people that I am involved in activism with see theory as something that's white, elitist, something they don't want nothing to do with, period. Which makes me kind of wonder about what it is that we're calling theory. Like, why does theory, you know, need to be happening in the academy? How can we change what the definition of theory is? And beyond just making theory accessible to lots of people, how can what lots of different people are doing become that theory?
You haven't spoken, so go ahead.
I'm really interested in this idea of trying to create alternate spaces where theory can happen, because I think that is crucial. And I feel really really ambiguous about the academy and what it does, because it does provide a kind of important space. But I spent 4 years in undergraduate school trying to do theory and activism at the same time, and it basically meant that you never sleep at all. And you always feel like you're doing everything half-assed. But I was also very, very committed to theory, because it's just, I love it. And I also think it's immensely important. And coming out of school, I just sort of jumped into, you know, a year of nothing but organizing. And in the process, kind of discovered praxis for the first time. Even though while I was in college, I'd been thinking about, you know, what does it mean to have theory emerge from real practice, you know, and sort of like theorizing that constantly. Mm-hmm. And And in the last year, I've sort of realized that it's actually not something that you can... Well, you can theorize it, but you really have to do it. And you can't really... Like, theorizing praxis without doing praxis is ridiculous. That's kind of the point of praxis. And so... And it's been really exciting to me. I feel like my theoretical life has become 1,000 times richer now that I'm doing organizing all the time and doing theory at, like, 2 o'clock in the morning. And so I guess I'm really excited about the possibility of trying to create more spaces, whether they be, you know, different kinds of collectives, whether they be some kinds of non-institutionalized institutions, where we can have theory as, you know, an important, respected thing coexisting simultaneously with all other sorts of political activity. I mean, why shouldn't organizers and theorists, you know, be the same people, but why shouldn't they be living together in the same space, being engaged in the same kind of struggles, you know, moving away from discipline-based theory to problem-based theory, where it's actually sort of on the ground. And, I mean, there's a few of us working in Maine right now to create some kind of a space where we can start to do that. And you know, I'm always thinking, like, should I go back to graduate school? I really want that, like, theoretical space. And so I've kind of decided to myself, well, I'm going to try and create it outside of graduate school. And if I can't do that in the next 5 years, then maybe I'll go back. But it's sort of like an ultimatum. But I'd love to hear people's ideas about what some of those spaces would look like, because I think we can do it.
Yeah, those are really worthwhile efforts, and that needs to be done. There's also an important task of subverting the university itself, though, and that's critical, I think, partially because the university has all these resources. Not every university, most of the education in the country, most of the pedagogy above the secondary level in the United States doesn't go on at Columbia and Berkeley, where Judith Butler and Spivak are, those sorts of institutions. It goes on at the 3,000 universities like where I teach at Cal State Long Beach, where, you know, my students are black bloc activists. You know, there are people who get arrested fighting cops, right? And so, you know, there are always opportunities there for the university to become a site of engagement. And one thing that's important is to call your professors on that, you know. When they're not actively engaged in taking part in the sorts of things that they're theorizing about, you know, that's a critical issue that they need to be confronted with. And conversely, when opportunities present themselves for a critical pedagogy to be introduced, they're there. And you know, the Mescaleros didn't have to go through the stages of metallurgy to figure out how to use a rifle, right? They just took them and used them very effectively. And theory is like that. You don't have to be cultivated in an upper class, prep school environment to suddenly figure out that you can get a lot out of Heidegger and Nietzsche and Marx and the anarchist critiques of those as well, for practical political purposes. So that's stuff that everyone can be engaged in.
I kind of want to speak to that because I'm not really sure that it's just a matter of, you know, all of a sudden reaching this enlightenment where you get into Heidegger, because, like we're saying, that this theory isn't really accessible to all people, and I don't know, like, just the language is just so, like, I don't know, just so cumbersome, and I just kind of feel like it's just so disconnected from the people that I work with, and immigrants and refugees that just don't have that privilege, people that are, like, you know, fleeing from police states that don't have, like, aren't in that space where they can kind of go out and risk arrest or whatever, because, you know, they're coming from a place where it's not going to be too comfortable in jail. So I'm like, I don't know, like, I'm kind of, like, really struggling with the value even of theory, and I'm just interested in how people, like, how do you take that theory and live that out, like, it, is it two like very separate worlds for people, or is it like when you're at a demonstration you're thinking about Foucault like the whole time, or like what's happening, like, or like is it, you think about it like after and then you think about it and journal on it and kind of like integrate it that way? And is it even possible, like what is the value of that then if it's not really helping you become more and more connected with other people around you?
I think it's important to look at that as not seeing theory, like you said, as outside of yourself, but like I think any person finding themselves in a political situation, it only takes a certain series of questions to really intersect with that theory. And that if there's people already out there that have done that same thinking, that have come to similar conclusions that you can find useful, that's immensely useful. Now, of course, there's a disconnect between like maybe a refugee fleeing from somewhere that's going to find something that Marx or Gramsci wrote or something, but at the same time, I don't think there's a need to denigrate that, and we can find, for me, I think study groups are a really important place. That this other guy was talking about, how can we pursue theory outside of an academic setting or whatever, and I've been out of college for a couple of years and grappling with some of those same things, but the study group is such a great place where you can look at these ideas, but you're looking at it and you're trying to find what's useful for you politically, rather than just like, oh, it's a justification for my already academic career or whatever. And I think like where you come at it from, that's where some people I find really inspiring, like Murray Bookchin, who's come at it from like a revolutionary perspective. He's not trying to get tenure, he's not trying to do this or that or the other thing, and then justifies radicalism, but it stems out of that. And like theory should be something that enables us as revolutionaries to make revolution, rather than justify our position or justify our intellect or whatever.
On what you just said, I definitely feeling with you here about how a lot of times people that are on the ground and are dealing with some stuff, this, you know, this really tense, they don't have time to be reading Jameson. Like, part of that I'm seeing is that Jameson isn't speaking to the issues. And also, something else I'm trying to be as inarticulate as possible here. The lack of theory that's existing right now, that's really important and valid right now. I think that might be reflected in the fact that a lot of theory is happening in the academy, and the academy is not allowing anything that's rocking the boat. I'm finding a lot of myself, I'm not really that interested in theory, in all honesty, and I, you know, feel bad about that sometimes, but part of that is because when I go to read theory, it has little application. Like, I mean, I, you know, of course, like, you know, history is important, and I can definitely make, you know, things that Marx says can definitely be applicable, but there's so little theory out there that's really super intellectual or otherwise that's really helpful right now, I'm finding. I don't know if other people have had a different experience.
People seem to, it's kind of in response to what you said, Bill, so that people seem to be talking about thinking intellectually or theoretically as a privilege, as, well, the reason why they don't get it is because they haven't been privileged to think this way. And I have. I've been in private school my whole life, and I don't think I think this way. I've been reading theory for a few years, and I still don't get it. Like, every time I go to it, I struggle with it. And I wonder if it's because it's, like, it's not very applicable, if it doesn't speak to the issues, or if it's just because not, it's just not the way I think in those big words or in these paragraph-long sentences. Like, I just can't break it down, you know? So I think that's been a problem with it, is that it just, even for people who have been privileged enough like me to be in that kind of setting my whole life, I still don't get it, you know?
I have to say that the counterpoint to that would be me. I came completely to my politics through theory. So I think it's, you know, different strokes for different folks. The only thing that allowed me to sort of break with the liberal indoctrination of my public school education was through Foucault and post-structuralism. It's the only way that I would have ever been allowed to see the problems with what I had learned up to that point. So it's, you know, whatever floats your boat.
Well, it just seems so discouraging to me if there are people that are struggling through it that have had that comfort have to be in school, then how much more hard is it going to be for someone that doesn't have the English language? Well, it doesn't have to be in English, there are translations, but I mean, like, how much more inaccessible is that? And so why are we making it so complicated for ourselves? Like, why can't we just talk to each other? I don't understand. Like, I don't know. And I'm not sure. Maybe I kind of, because I really haven't read Anarchist Theory, and maybe that's, like, it's not fair for me to be saying that, but it just, like, even in this very room, I feel very alienated because I don't have the jargon. But I'm not sure I really want the jargon because obviously you're all struggling with it, and I'm not sure I want that barrier. So, like, I'm not, like, I see it as a way to look at things, but then at the same time, I'm really cautious of, like, the lenses that I want to put on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's, like, we have 5 minutes and four hands just put up, so right now, and they're all people who've spoken before, so
yeah.
There's no way of, like, triaging. So you, okay. you, and you in some order, and then I guess we'll probably end.
I agree with what Slade said, it's not a class or a privileged background that gets you thinking in theory. It's I think it's a tendency to use a different side of your brain. You're more mathematical about your thoughts, and you tend toward the abstract, and it'll bring you toward this theoretical side of the discussion. I'm also not in that theoretical side, but as far as the other discussion about neologisms and so forth, I think that, first of all, people work on finding new words for things that are already widely understood so that they can establish themselves as doing something new when they're actually not doing something new or saying something new. It's like in social services, you'll redefine that, like, it's not a resident, it's a client, or it's a consumer now, and we have to stop saying that and start saying this, and that's the new news. And it's just a way of perpetuating a career and seeming more relevant to human life than one actually is.
I'm just wondering, like, when we're talking about, you know, theory being inaccessible, and, you know, the fact that these obscure languages, you know, not everyone can get it, I'm wondering if we're giving too much power to theory, as if theory is something that everyone should get because theory is, like, sort of like the ultimate truth. It's like the skeleton underneath all of reality. And, you know, and so everyone should get there, and it's like the privilege to get there, and whoever gets there wins, you know. And, I mean, I would rather think of theory as another tool, along with a lot of other tools that we use. And so I'm kind of wondering, you know, what's the difference then between a very technical language of theory and a very technical language that's manifested in, like, the skills of painting, or a very technical language manifested in the skills of fixing a car? I mean, just a question to throw out. I don't know. Maybe not giving theory so much power in as, like, the thing that everybody needs to get all the time.
Jessica.
Tamara.
Sorry.
That's okay. So many thoughts. I'm so hungry for this conversation we're having right now. I think we need to really reconceptualize theory and the way we're thinking about it. It's not just this esoteric, like, stuff that we're talking about. Everybody theorizes. Everybody does it in their lives. We all think and imagine, like, try to explain and understand what's going on in our lives. I think we really need to, like, stop talking about theory as just this thing that we've been talking about it as. But I would also like to just say that this conversation we're having right now, like, a lot of the questions we're raising are exactly the questions I'd like to pursue later on this afternoon, so I hope to carry forward this discussion about critical pedagogy and about what kinds of alternative, like, spaces we need to be creating to do kind of liberatory education and to do theory in a way that kind of reconceptualizes what it is, so later on at 4.
Yeah, that's great, because I was going to say, in my thesis, I didn't just use theory. I mean, I think we need to also think about, we give theory a lot of power by creating theory as theory, and to think about how else, if we want to reconceptualize it,
reconceptualize it. So a lot of my theory came from all the flyers I picked up at all the stuff I've been going to, of the brilliant things that there's lots of theory on our movement out there, actually, and they're sitting on tables on flyers as broadsheets that a lot of people who've come to this conference have been putting out and creating, that have informed my master's thesis, that I could have cared less how much people didn't credit what I was, you know, because to me that's what it was. And so, I mean, it's there. So we have to remember to not make those distinctions as much in our own anxieties, which are valid, but we contribute to that as much as anything else. So to recognize it exists, and we are creating it. You're right. It's there. We're all doing it. So
it's like officially 10:45. So does anybody like really need the last word, or can we end? It's all good. Okay. Thank you.